fishing, it's in my soul. Welcome to the Salt Strong Podcast, disrupting fishing entertainment as you know it. Prepare to laugh. Prepare to get to know fishing legends in a whole new and unfiltered way.
And on occasion, you might even learn a thing or two about fishing.
Here's your host, Joe Simons. Like diamonds.
Hello, Salt Strong Nation. Joe Simons. Like diamonds. We are back. Got my main man, Captain Ronnie Kinner. What's up, brother?
What's going on, man? How you been doing, brother?
Oh, crazy times right now, but I love the fact that we can talk about fishing, we can dream about fishing, and even do a little bit of fishing. And kind of a background on you, I don't know how much you know how I heard about you. I don't even remember who it was. I get so many messages, and I hear a lot of things like, you got to get so-and-so in the podcast. And I got this message. I'll have to dig it up, and I'll put it in the blog post because I apologize. I don't have his name. But whoever it was, thank you. And he's like, hey, you need to get this guy, Captain Ronnie Kinner. He's like, and the next line was like, he is one of the best coaches. He's sharing everything. He's even doing like these on the water, like basically like a guided little seminar, like on the boat on the water. And he's even got haters out there of like, you know, other captains because he's sharing too much, which is like us. Like some of our biggest haters, as you guys know, are some of these old captains out there that just think we're sharing too much with you, the consumer. And our whole mission here, just like Captain Ronnie, which I believe we're going to hear about in a second, is all about just sharing. We want more people out in the water. And when they're out in the water, we want it to be a more enjoyable experience. Everyone wins. It's that whole spread it out as far as you can, right? I mean, if you have a good time, you're going to be telling your kids about it and your friends and your neighbors about it. You're going to be more encouraged and more inclined to get your kids and your grandkids out in the water. So that's what we're all about. And so I'm pumped to hear this story. And I talked offline with you, Ronnie, and you mentioned something about your grandfather. What's the deal? He was kind of the main figure that got you into fishing?
Oh, absolutely, man. Hands down. I was very fortunate that he had three daughters in a trial run trying to have a son to share some knowledge with, but he spent his entire life growing up with fishing and actually toured for a long time, many, many years ago, was full sponsored out, made a lot of his own rigs and stuff. And I ended up coming along and was extremely fortunate to be the one to be there for him to share all that knowledge with. And I still to this day, even though he's no longer with us, can't thank him enough for the grounding basis of anything you need to know about fishing, you know, starting me off. It was an awesome experience for me growing up. Absolutely.
And did you grow up in Charleston in South Carolina area?
Yes, sir. I was the actual first in my family born Charleston native. He was in the Navy, so they were all over the place, but he got settled here in Charleston in 1972 and decided he loved it. It was everything he wanted, fresh water, salt water, fisherman's paradise, basically. So he pulled the trigger on retirement, and a couple years later, along came I, being the first in the family born here. I'd never go anywhere else, man. I love it.
That's awesome, man. And so how long have you been guiding there?
I've personally been here, you know, 35, going on 36 years, been fishing since I was four, fished with a lot of friends off and on, helping them out, you know, all growing up, but I didn't really get full-time grounded into the guided life, you know, until about 5-6 years ago. But, you know, with a family and stuff, you know, with all the competition, as many people do it, it kind of can be intimidating at first, but, you know, you go out there, be yourself and, you know, do what you got to do. And I assure you it'll all work out in the end, man.
And you've made a name for yourself, which is how I heard about you, about doing some of these, you know, on the boat seminars. Cause I think in general, people think of fishing guides less like a pro golfer, right? Like, you know, at a country club, you might go hire a golfer and it's more about tutorials. With a fishing guide, it's more about entertainment, right? If we're going to be honest, in general, you're usually going out there to get entertained, to be able to drink some beers and just have someone who knows what they're doing put you on a ton of fish, and you do that as well. But one thing you've been trying recently is some of these on the boat kind of seminars, kind of like what we do at Salt Strong, but on the boat, like on the water, where you're showing people, hey, like not only like here's how you rig it, let's actually toss it in the water and show you what kind of spot I'm in and why I'm in that fishing spot and how we're catching fish so consistently.
Absolutely, man. It works out so much better because it's you know, it's like reading a book and reading instructions versus watching someone actually you know, assemble something or put it together in front of you. It's one thing to talk about it. It's another thing to actually be right there in person, live, on the action, seeing it happen and seeing, you know, everything in full detail being explained. You know, when it comes to talking about wind variances and all that, you just, it's so much different being an in-person experience versus just trying to describe it. It works out very well.
Well, today, at least we have the second best thing, which is hearing you talk about it. So
you're
in Charleston. One of the big things we hear from our audience a lot, and this really starts from, like, you know, Jacksonville all the way up, and of course, you know, even the Gulf and places, Texas, Louisiana, is catching redfish and catching speckled trout in murky water. And also, and so that's part one, and part two are places with these massive tidal swings. You know, like my in-laws are in Savannah. My wife's a Savannah, Georgia girl, and I go there and go fishing. And, like, you know, I'm looking at my Smart Fishing Tides little app, and I'm like, holy smokes, there's like a nine foot swing here today. And, like, that's, even though I know a redfish is a redfish is a redfish, I mean, they all have the same kind of biology and tendencies. That still plays a fact when you're talking about that much tidal swing. So I want to talk about both. I don't know how you want to handle that in terms of which one you want to tackle first. What are your thoughts?
Man, either way, it doesn't matter to me. Right, I'm fine with which one.
Let's go murky water. Everything from, you know, just the mistakes that you think people make, or are people overthinking it, how you're using online maps to find, you know, good honey holes in murky water. I know you use a lot of popping corks. I've seen some of your videos before to fish in different structure docks. So take it away, my friend, just like if I was on the boat with you.
Yeah, man. So I want to get into a little more depth on it. First off, all I focus on is murky, dirty water. A lot of people always look for clean water because, you know, it's more visibility and stuff like that. But there's a lot of negative downsides in clean water. The biggest being that clear water, first off, is very low in nutrient. So dirty, cloudy water usually has a lot more sediment, nutrients and stuff in it, which down the food chain equals usually a lot more bait and a lot more food source and a lot more biology going on, which in turn equals usually a lot more fish. But a lot of people, hey man, you know, I don't want to fish with that stuff. It's too nasty. It's too dirty. You know, they struggle with it. And so one of the biggest things that I like to try to focus on, just with us talking dirty water in general, not referencing tides yet, would be, there's a couple things that come into play. And the very first thing that I tell anybody out on a boat or anywhere in general discussing this is going to be casting. If you are not a dead accurate spot on with casting, and I don't mean just in one direction, left, backwards, flip, overhead. However, if you can't get it in a bucket 5 out of 6 times, you know, that's what you're going to need to start off with. And the reason I say that is because you are in dirty, murky water. It's not crystal clear. You can't see, but, you know, 6, 8, 15, 20 inches away from target. So that being said, the very first thing is you're going to have to get your bait exactly where your bait needs to be. So what we find here with a lot, what we deal with and clients see it firsthand with me all of the time, is you can be no more than 12 inches to 2 foot away from the target spot where you will guarantee hook up and not get a nibble, a bite, a strike, or anything going on with your bait. You literally have to be dead in that zone to get that fish. So that being said, there's a lot of times with a lot of people, and I'll go out and I'll just let them roll through areas and see what they do. And they don't, you know, they might be aggressive and they might, you know, do everything they can to hit through the spot and cast it at every angle and every position, what possible, but they might not get it tight enough to a piece of structure or to where they might assume of getting hung up. Like if you're fishing some rocks to a grass line, you know, and you're wanting to fish that change up in structure where the two variances come together. I like that myself personally, rocks to grass, rocks to mud, mud to grass, whatever. You're going to want to put it right where you think you're going to lose it. You're going to lose your bait. And that's usually where, you know, where the fish are going to be at, right in there where those crabs and everything will be crawling around. So you're going to want to, first off, get it where you think you shouldn't be putting it at, and risk losing what you got going on to make sure that you're hitting it correctly. And so that's going to be the very utmost first important thing I would tell people, is to definitely dial down and be very precise when it comes to work in an area in very dirty, murky water. Now that, you know, you got the casting aside and that's not a problem, I can do that, then great. The next biggest thing that I focus on with the cloudiness is going to be, especially for your artificial guys and stuff like that, is hands down vibration. If you're not using, you know, it don't matter if it's a grub, you know, a spinner bait, whatever. If it's a grub, it needs to have a big paddle tail on it. Something that you know is going to, you know, be pushing some movement through the water that those fish are going to be picking up on. So when they're surrounded, you know, 99% of their life by water conditions where they can't see but a few inches, smell and their lateral line vibration is 100% what they're going to be relying on. You might as well treat the fish almost like the fish is blind, and you know, what you got to do to approach it. So vibration being key, with using anything that's going to put some nice sonic vibes in the water. I personally, hands down, like spinner baits, without a doubt, or rattle traps. For some people, rattle traps will work very well, but I like to use the spinner baits, and I don't personally swim it. All right. Unless I'm trying to catch some trout, you know, top water, I don't swim the bait, and I'll talk about that in a second. But what I do with the bladed baits is I like to, again, with the casting, get it dead to the target, and or like if I'm hitting a real shallow, you know, mud flat or a rake that doesn't have anything I'm too worried about getting hung up on, I may even toss it just shy of the edge of the water so that I don't even make too much of an intrusive noise. Let that bait get all the way down to the bottom, and I'll do quick little jigging type retrieves on the bait, allowing the jig bait, you know, your bladed bait, to go right back down to the bottom, and then rip it back up just a few inches, and then let it fall right back down to the bottom. And that works incredibly well for me. And you'll get every species, you know, doing it that way, especially your flounder and stuff, because you're getting it down low. And, you know, the redfish being definitely the main thing you're wanting to focus on is going to be riding along right on that bottom. So you're going to be hitting that bait on the bottom and making that little vibration, kind of pulling it up, and then going right back to the target zone. Don't waste the time, you know, throwing it in tight and retrieve it a little bit from the bank. And unless you're trying to focus on trout or something a little further in some deeper water, you know, just quickly get it right back to the boat. There's no need to waste any excessive time trying to fish the entire column coming back to the boat. Fish it within a few feet of where you know the fish are, rip it back in, and then, you know, rip it back out again.
So to kind of reiterate that point, because the redfish are going to be usually tighter to that structure, whether it's underneath the dock or on the edge of that grass line, they're not going to be hitting your lure 2 feet from your boat, right?
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. Okay. Yeah. And
yeah, keep going.
No, go ahead, man. Yeah, go ahead. Go for it.
So two quick questions on that. One, do you, on your spinner baits, do you use like a little paddle tail, like a little trailer or anything? Like what are you using on, or any kind of brand that you like?
Yeah. So, I mean, when I very first started freshwater, I mean, saltwater fishing, I was throwing freshwater, you know, dual willow bladed spinner baits, just like what you would use in a lake. And they actually work very, very well, because they tend, in my opinion, to put off a little bit more vibration, but the shank and shaft of the bait just doesn't hold up as well. Especially with the redfish, because you get some nice reds, they fight aggressively. It just annihilates the spinner bait. So in the salt water, the redfish magic works really well. And I go heavier than you assume you're going to need, unless you're fishing, you know, somewhere with no current, because you're going to want to get to the bottom. And I do usually have a grub on there, no kind of skirt or nothing like that. But just a nice little grub, you know, with a paddle tail on it as well. That way you're still getting every bit of vibration you can.
Cool. All right. So number two, because this is the counterintuitive part about fishing in murky water. A lot of people would think, well, hey, it's murky, I could be a horrible caster, right? They think that you need to be a good caster in clear water. When you say, you know, you have a specific spot, talk through that. So you know, someone's trying to visualize what you're talking about. What are you trying to hit?
All right. So that's an absolute awesome question, man. Seriously, that really is going to kind of confuse a few people because, like you said, it's very counterintuitive. If the fish now are more keen to be insensitive to noises and stuff like that, and they might also, if they're worrying about predators and stuff, if you get too close on that approach and you know, landing of throwing your bait out dead onto the fish, that typically doesn't end well unless you just perfectly get it right across their nose, and you might have that random red that just spooked and ate the bait all at the same time trying to kill it. But usually I always go for what I tell the client, the most natural approach as possible. And for murky water, for a lot of people, that is going to be where a popping cork type method, don't worry about the live bait or grub or whatever, but the cork itself, and I'm going to explain why, comes in so handy. Because these fish are used to a natural type pattern. Those reds, just like you said, that was amazing what you said, man. They hold dead onto that structure. So if they're feeding in a 2-foot line on a rock edge with a little bit of spikes of grass or whatever along it, they are literally, imagine, you know, a 2-foot wide, you know, sidewalk or pathway underwater. And that is the only area they're going to stay in, you know, at a 90% of the time. They're going to run right in that line and tight on that structure. So that being said, you're going to want to approach them naturally. So if you're in a position or a situation where, you know, your water is going one way, left to right, or right to left, whatever, you're going to want to come ahead of where you think the fish are going to be at. Like, for example, if I'm in between two docks, and it looks really good, I've scouted it at low tide, there's a bunch of oysters on the bottom, you know, a lot of area for food, they're clean a little bit, I can tell stuff's been feeding on them, you know, you got some rocks on the left side of them, and then there'll be a grass line on the right, and then right in the middle, the grass is loose, and it kind of meets together. That change up in that little safety zone of bait, that's most likely going to be where that fish is at. So I'm going to come back to that area now that the water's up a little bit, and I can fish it. And let's say the water is going from right to left, and I think those fish are going to be right where that grass and rock come together over top of those oysters. So if I can approach it 10 to 15 feet ahead of it to the right, Okay. Throw your bait in over there, and then let your bait drift right into the fish as if it was a natural bait in the water, and the current was just bringing it right to the fish. Hands down is going to net you the most fish in a single outing that you're going to get, because you're in no way disturbing the natural anatomy of what's going on right there. And that being said, usually what will happen is if you're fishing, and especially if you've got a couple people in the boat, the fish are going to get excited because everything that just went on was as natural as it could have been. Oh, crap, here comes a little water bait coming through the water. Let's get pumped up. Just like bass exploding on, you know, baby shad and stuff in the water. It's all the same thing. So your bait comes in natural. You hook into a fish. If you're with someone else in a boat, you're immediately, just like if you were chasing schoolies or whatever, telling them, get the bait in the water, get it in. They come in right behind you. And 9 out of 10, they're gonna hook up. So you're gonna have a double up immediately. If you've got a third person in the boat and there's enough fish around, he's gonna come right in behind y'all and he's gonna hook up. And if y'all could do that as long as possible, you will literally for an hour, 2 hours straight, one after another, catch the fish as long as you always lead the area of approaching where the fish is at. You do not want it to land on them. I can verify this a million times over that, you know, we've been out and murky conditions. Oh, I know it needs to be close to the fish, whatever. And we might have been, you know, working a jig or a grub or a spinner bait. And you just like, man, they're just not seeing it. They're just not seeing it. And you try to throw it right at them or anywhere to the, you'll notice that it spooks out the entire group. You'll hit it right in there and you might have 15, 20, 50, 100, whatever, fish in an area. You throw it right in there, and it smacks one on the head or whatever. The fish immediately drums under the water, distresses out. The entire group of fish has now dispersed and is gone. And on top of that, their anxiety level's up, and they're under precautionary mode where they're now just looking around for any kind of predatorial, you know, thing that might come in and inflict damage. So you're no longer going to get any success with that group of fish. and it's going to be done for you. So that being said, I definitely don't ever try to throw it dead on to where the fish is at. And that's why when it comes to the grubs and the artificials, you know, unless you're hitting trout, a lot of people, hey man, I have no problem catching trout, but I just don't do good on the redfish on artificial, you know, murky or clear water. Don't matter.
Yeah.
A lot of that's going to be because the trout are in deeper water. All right. And you're going to be cross hatching, casting a deeper ridge or a channel, and you're not disturbing those fish before that bait gets in there. Well, the redfish being tight to the structure, shallower water, all that being said, it's a lot higher percentage that when you toss into that area, you're in some way, shape, or form going to affect, you know, what went on and might disturb that fish. So if you can, you're going to want to put it beyond it, hanging a little bit in the grass. You know what I mean? Like hanging up a little bit, be risky. Don't be scared to lose a few rigs. You know, hang it up a little bit, finesse it into the water. Or if you can, me personally, I like to get an inline 2-0 or 3-0 Gamakatsu weighted hook.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll take a 3-inch gulp shrimp. All right. It don't matter if it's molten color, natural color, whatever. But cut the tail off of it. And then you rig it tail side first so that the head is what's facing away from you, okay, away from the eyelet of the hook. And what this does is because of that hook being so narrow with the inline weight, and then you're rigging it weedless, and then when you cut that little tip of the tail off, you now have a perfectly little skippable object.
Yeah.
And what makes this so fantastic is this is what I personally do 90% of the time, because you can't always just pitch it into the mud or whatever, is now you have an object you can just skip it across the water and have that bait just kind of, you know, gently go into the area where the fish is at. And that's why fly fishermen have a lot more success when it comes to tactics where you have to be dead around the fish at landing the fish, because the fly itself presents itself so much more natural and just quiet and soft onto the water. If that makes sense.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I want to talk about some of the baits. So you mentioned spinner bait, and then we talked about popping corks, and now we have this kind of unique little weedless rig gulp shrimp. I love
that. Man.
So, what's your go to? I assume with your clients, you're probably using popping corks more often than not.
Yeah, okay. When it comes to the clients, man, unless I'm getting repeat or someone out there that's hands down like, hey, I'm with artificials or whatever, we're going to definitely go with the corks, because they're going to have a brand new person, never could touch a rod in their life. And within, you know, 30 minutes to an hour, they're going to have a good enough understanding with it and with the approach of it. And they're going to immediately go from a beginner to a novice at catching fish, you know, because it's so successful at not spooking the fish. You can approach them so naturally.
And what are you using underneath the cork? What's your favorite?
So, me personally, as far as artificial wise, I like to go with the, so you're going to want to be tied into the structure. So that being said, some people may want, you know, an eye jig or whatever, but I personally still go again with the weedless hook with a little bit of a weight to it. And, I'm not worried about, you know, an eyeball reflection or nothing like that. I personally am not too worried about that, but I like to use the smoke colored black flake, gulp, swimming mullet 3-inch. And it'll have the curly tail on it. And I just kind of rigged that right on there. And you'll go, we focus a lot here. And the redfish here stay in a pretty good average depth range for what we do. We find them a lot in 2 to 3 foot of water. So I'm always running 3, max 3.5, 4 foot leader under the cork. But that gulp bait for Mr. Artificial Guy is going to hands down get it done for you. Smoke color at that, but of course anything live bait with a cork, you know, mud minnow, shrimp, whatever, is going to be very highly effective as well.
Cool. So when do you use the other two? Like, is that kind of your arsenal for the most part? Spinner, the popping cork?
Yeah, man. I mean, I keep it when it comes to the murky water. Like I said, there's a few things that get it done. And there's no real reason for me other than, like, if the fish are real, real slow, approach-wise is going to be different. I can get into that if you want. But, you stick to what works, and that's what's going to keep you being successful. If you start going through a bunch of different stuff and freaking yourself out, you know, you're never going to get it dialed down. But yeah, I'll always, if I only had a little select tackle box, it is hands down going to be the spinner bait over anything. If it was Ronnie, you have one and one bait only at all that you can go fishing with. I don't care what you're fishing for. That's it. That's the only thing you can use. For me personally, it's going to be a spinner bait. Mm-hmm. But next to that is going to be the weedless grub. And the reason that I like it so much is because of casting. Like I said, casting is, when it comes to me, most important. So my bait, in some sense, has to be, you know, very easy and reliable at casting. So when I can make that nice little kind of altered little grub, like I said, cutting it down and making it real short, almost like a little Ned rig, real, real tiny and short. Doesn't need to be big. And that just gives you the ability to get it where you need to get it at. Like if you're fishing a dock, or, you know, you're like got this one dock's got a lot of oysters and stuff on the pilings underneath or whatever, and you're just like, man, that just looks so tasty. There's got to be a fish down there. Well, how in the heck, you know, when it's only a foot and a half or 2 foot from the water and it might be 15 feet under there, do I get to that spot? Well, that little grub is going to skip like candy right under there. And then what I personally do is I'm going to, again, going right back to that jigging technique, but with the grub, I'll do it a little different. If I'm focusing on some reds on the bottom at a dock, I'm going to, in this situation, if I know the fish are holding right on a piling at a dock with some oysters or whatever, and there might be risk or difficulty with corks and whatnot, perfect scenario for this bait. You're going to skip it right into the dock or the position and let it fall all the way to the bottom. And I personally, for this, you know, some people disagree with me because they say, oh, you're fishing heavy structure, you need a stiff rod to rip the fish out. But I'm going for fish count. All right. I ain't too worried about getting a single fish out. I want to catch fish, not a single fish. So I go with a rod with a very loose, fast action tip, and it's going to sit on the bottom, and I'll hold it dead above the water, pointing straight down. And I just kind of twitch it as lightly as I can, and that going towards the vibration. And all that it's going to do with that bait is you can just imagine like a barely alive bait on the bottom, just kind of twitching for life and just barely sliding along, you know, not even really moving. And boy, I can't tell you how many fish I've caught doing that.
That's awesome. Let's talk about positioning and approach, you know, speaking of that. And I think that's one of those things, Ronnie, that is left out of the conversation so much, right? We all want to talk about baits and how we're rigging them. And I've seen guys out there on the water, I know you have too. And I mean, they're plowing up to, like, you know, down here we have the mangrove trees. I mean, I've saw this guy, I mean, he's literally like reversing him before he plows in. And I was like, you ain't going to catch nothing.
Nothing, dude, nothing. So I call that blowing out the spot.
Yes. Real fast. So talk about that, just some overall positioning and approach tips. You know, I think just like we talked about casting, there's this perception that, hey, it's murkier, they're not going to be as spooky, I can be a whole lot louder, I can, you know, get right on top of them. What are your thoughts?
Yep. All right. So again, this is a fantastic question, and it's so fantastic that I truly feel, Joe, that probably is half the reason that people don't catch fish. Mm. And I'll go a little into depth first, and let me say that it was the first thing once out on the water that my grandfather taught me was approach. The first thing once on the water, if you can't get into the spot right and you scare them off, you're never going to catch one. So who cares how you're fishing for them? So coming into an area, again, always, always, always come into an area concerned that the fish know you're coming in there. Don't ever just come into it like they have no clue, man. The fish are clueless. Don't never act like that. How do you want to approach it, though? You want me to approach it tidal wise first, or you want me to just in general approaching a spot, then discuss how you would approach it with the tide? What do you want me to, how do you want me to?
Yeah,
go
just
that?
Do general first, and then let's talk about tides, because that's kind of part two of where we're going anyway. So it's a great segue.
So first off, and this isn't a shout out for power pole, but dude, if you can get a power pole or a talon, it's really priceless when it comes to approach. And the reason I say that, I see a lot of guys, man, and I don't mean to chuckle, but they'll come up, you know, in a boat or whatever, and first off, they come in too fast. All right, just like you said, blowing out the spot. Oh yeah, I mean, my boat does 35. Let me just shoot in here as quick as I can. That is first off the worst thing that you can do. I always, and I have had clients ask me why, what am I doing, and I explain it, and then they quickly forget about it when the rods start bending. But why did we slow down? So what's going on? Is something wrong? No, sir. We're going right over there. Well, first off, you know, I don't want to wake it out, you know, because for one, there's a few things that go on with that. And I'll just explain a couple basics. A little too noisy, whatever, you know, might kind of make something know what's up. But something that many people don't think about is there's sediment and all that on, you know, the structure and all the stuff that you're trying to fish. Well, I mean, if you're already in cloudy, murky water, why not make it dirtier and make it harder on yourself? Go in there, shake the water up, make waves, make the mud stir up, and blind everything. I mean, so don't do it. Just don't do it. So when I come in, I come completely off throttle, and, you know, a few hundred feet out from the area, definitely off throttle, and just idle on in real gently. You know, and I personally don't have a problem with coming right into the area on motor, but if you're shifting gears and you're not good at adjusting your boat and in and out of gear select where it's banging underwater, then don't do that. If you have a trolling motor, kind of put your trolling motor down and maybe ease into the area. But now that you know not to come in like that, what a lot of guys do wrong, even if they do approach it right, is they'll have a chain and anchor or whatever, and they just, you know, it's like they're trying to hit the scoreboard on who can make the biggest splash throwing the anchor in the water. So all of that going to the same thing. And or they may gently put the anchor down, but then they've got 10-foot of road with the chain all rattling down the side of the boat and stuff like that. Again, all of this being unnatural noises and sounds that are going on where you're trying to fish. So I just avoid all that. I come in soft and easy. You know, me personally, I'm fairly good at boat control, so I use my engine. I don't troll motor into a spot unless it's too deep for power poles, and I use a troll motor for anchor lock. But I come in nice and easy, and I'm already prejudging current and wind and all that and letting my boat drift in. I'm not throttling in. I drift in. Mm. And then when I get to where I want, I just one time I'll put it in gear far away, just enough to the point where it slows the boat down, put my poles down, and I kill it. And that way, you know, the littlest disturbance and noise is possible.
Awesome. All right. So now let's talk about how you do all of the stuff with these crazy tides, your favorite tides and moon phases or any of that stuff that you have. Because I'm curious on that, too, because it's, you know, as a Florida boy, it is different when you have those massive tidal swings.
Dude, I love it, man. It's nothing like getting a Florida client that goes, holy hell, I'm used to a foot and a half, and it's a 7-foot swing today, you know, and I just start cracking. Yeah, man, this is everyday life for me. You know, 6-7 foot tide is normal. 5-5.5 would be what I call a neap tide. That's a weaker tide for us. And then, 7 and 8 is going to be a king tide, good moon phase, you know, and or a lot of rain combined, whatever. That being said, you know, the number one question that everybody asks when they're booking a trip, when, yeah. And you know what I tell them, be at the landing at 7 o'clock in the morning. And, and the reason I say that, and you know, you'll dial it all in and it doesn't matter, you know, unless like a certain weather condition for the day, you know, hey, it's blowing 35 mile an hour first thing and pouring rain and it's going to be calm and sunny at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. All right, we're going at 3, you know. That, okay. But other than that, if it's a normal day, it's so be it, because the tide can be chased, the fish can be chased, all of that stuff varies and moves throughout the day. So I'm trying to think of where to start this, because I could literally talk for like 10 hours on tide. But so what I personally like, first off, is incoming water, all right, which is contradictory to what a lot of people say, or what I hear from so many. Oh, I like the falling tide, low falling, whatever. Yeah, you know, because it concentrates the fish. It can make it a little easier, but it's not much to do with productivity. So me personally, I like the incoming. I have over my 20,000+ hours on the water, logged and everything else, found the incoming tide on logged books and keeping data is the most productive tide. And I will explain why. Being so is, for me, what I find is falling tide. When you look at the, let's get a little scientific on it, but the way the water comes out, you know, the heavier, faster water is in the middle, starting off slow from the side. All right. So on falling tide, it all kind of gets sucked to the middle. So the reason I'm saying that is as that water's falling, and you know it, especially on a big tide, falling big tide, man, this water was cloudy. Now it's like, dude, this thing looks like, this looks like someone made some tea and poured a gallon of milk in it. You know what I mean? Like you can't see a quarter millimeter in the water. And as that water's falling out, it's already dirty. And this is what we are talking about, dirty water on top of that. So when that tide's falling out, that mud and sediment that gets stirred up all gets drawn away from the bank. All right. So if you've ever been in there and you're fishing a spot, next time you go out, look at it and pay attention to this. I think that you might kind of be surprised. Falling tide, you'll notice as it starts getting down to where that clarity is going to really be affected, you'll see that mud line gets pulled out and away, and it kind of extends over the structural area where the fish are going to be at and all that, and it makes it even worse than what it already was. Now, flip the switch. On incoming, it pushes into, as that water is rising and it pushes in towards the bank, you'll notice that cloudy mud line gets pushed in and that clarity becomes better. It doesn't get clear because we're talking muddy water, dirty water, cloudy water, but it gets better than it was. So that clean, fresh incoming water just, for me, seems to be most productive. So that's what I tend to always have the best luck around. Now, being that we are talking about huge tide swings where you can get, you know, 3-4 knots of current, all right, like just blow people's mind current, you're going to want to focus on the laws in the tide, all right? And I don't mean the exact law, so I'll be a little more specific. So everybody knows tide dies, and then it stops, and then it comes back the other way, and then it dies and stops, and it goes the other way. So in the middle of that, let's refer to it as a choo-choo train, all right? Right when the tide's dead, train fired, engine up, and you're ready to start rolling. This is a big tide, so we know this train's going to hit 60 mile an hour. All right, so, but at the start of it, it's just barely moving. So as it just slowly starts, that's going to be your production hour. All right, so you know now it's a little more fishable. Water's not moving too aggressive. Train's just starting to take off. I can run on foot and go catch this damn thing. All right, so that's the production hour. Now, as that train's hauling ass, man, I can't, there ain't no way that thing will kill me. You know, it's rolling, and it's real difficult to fish. You can't fish correctly. Water's rolling. Water's moving too fast. Then, all of a sudden, train's going to slow down again, and then you're going to notice that last hour, hour and a half, as that water starts becoming stagnant or slower, that's when you're going to start hitting those fish again. Now, being that you now know the productive window of the tide, the biggest thing that you have to learn to do is what I always try to teach people is chasing the tide. You can have a spot, you know what I mean? One spot, but you've got to learn multiple areas that you can fish that are separated completely away from where you're at. And I'm not saying like, you know, you're in a river somewhere and, you know, let's say there's just for a reference spot. Let's say that you're on a river and there's a golf course right there, you know, and there might be, you know, a span of a half a mile or whatever of docks and structure and stuff. All right. Mm-hmm. You can't go from one dock a half a mile down to another dock and expect the tide to be that much different. All right. You're going to have to chase it. So that being said, learn your waterway, learn the area around you, cut throughs and stuff like that. And look at the tide timetables and learn it, which ones that you can get closest to that have the biggest variances. That being said, I have areas that I can get to in boat 15 to 20 minutes apart that'll have a 2-hour window difference in time.
Wow.
So yeah, and that's the cake topper. All right, so it's one thing to have clients on the boat and have a productive hour or two. It's another thing to, on, you know, there are days that fish just don't bite it. You know what I mean? Like, don't get me wrong. But with all in all going right, and you're doing it right, this is what will change the day from I caught fish at 9 o'clock this morning to we caught 78 fish today. You know what I mean?
Yep.
We caught 130 fish today. How would you do that? Well, we chased the tide. So now that you know big water, you need to focus around the beginning and around the ending. You're going to be in an area, you know, and you might have an hour or two that's productive right there, that's fishable, and you're going to fish it, and let's hope that you're catching fish. Then, you know, you've already pre-planned, all right, tide's going to stop in 5 minutes. We're going to make a 20-minute boat run. Tide just started going out over there. You know what I mean? So you're going to go to that spot. Water's just starting to move, and it's slow, you know, and you're going to hit some fish on it. And then you're just going to continue doing stuff like that throughout the day. And then by the time you've done that a few times, another area is now going to be at the bottom half or at the second end of what's going on. And that's what will help you maintain your productivity throughout the day versus chasing the hour. You know, I've got to be out my house at 5 o'clock this morning, or I have to be on the water by 6:15 sharp. No, you don't. You just need to know where the tides are, what time the tides are going to be at, and then start to base your day around there. Now, can I get a little deeper on that as far as how wind affects it, or do you want
absolutely. Yeah, that would be super helpful.
All right. So this all being said, there's a lot of variables that you have to consider when it comes to the tides, planning these tides out, planning the time out and everything else. NOAA charts and all that, these are all nothing but predictions based on where the moon and sun is supposed to be at. So that's the only potential fixed variable that we got. There's many other things that now need to come into effect. So like for here, for us in Charleston, we have a southeastward facing harbor. All right. So when our tide falls, all of our accumulative water channels out, bottlenecks, comes through our harbor southeast out into the ocean. So I'm just going to focus on that and use that as an example. So if everything is flowing southeast, all right, okay, and we have a 20-mile-an-hour southeast wind, okay, that's blowing dead out the southeast, so right into our harbor. When we have a falling tide, if the tide's falling and going out southeast, but yet we have a counteractive 20, 25-mile-an-hour wind coming dead end southeast into the harbor, well, what's going to happen? That's a bottleneck. You know, the wind, as much as people don't think it will or whatever, it's going to push that volume of water, and you're going to have a different timetable in the tide. And also, if it's going to be a bigger tide and you know that, hey, falling tide today, we've got a big south wind, you know, it's going to be tough, but it's going to slow the water down. So that being said, it might be a little more productive because we already know if it gets too fast, you know, the fish won't bite as good. So that wind might keep the water a little slower and we might catch more fish. Okay, so now that you're thinking about that, put into retrospective the flip side. If it's incoming tide, wind still coming out the southeast, dead into the harbor, kind of speed up what's going on. Yeah. All right.
Freight train.
So there's, yes. So there's the counteractive effect. Now, there's a couple things you need to overlap and put into play here. If the water came in faster, harder, stronger with resistive wind when it's going to flip, if it was supposed to be high tide at 12, I'll almost put money it's going to be high tide at 12:30, 1 o'clock, because it's going to be pushing that water in high and it's going to hold it. You see what I'm saying?
Yep.
You're not going to, it'll be, okay, let me rephrase that. High tide 12, it might be high tide at 11:35 because water came in so fast and hard. High tide to a spot that you're used to, like, man, the water is already, it's higher than I even thought it was going to get already early. Then you go, all right, well, don't worry, tide's going to go out in 30 minutes. Well, so you and your buddy sit there, and then next thing you know, half the 12-pack's gone, you know, sandwich is gone, you're sitting there going, dude, I mean, I thought we were supposed to be getting falling tide at 12:30. You look down, it's 1:15, 1:30, and the water's still kind of just sitting there. And that's all going to be because of that southwest wind or that southeast wind holding that in. So those are just little pre-dumped factors that you need to kind of understand the areas to where you're going to be fishing and put a little more forethought into it, other than I looked at the tide chart, you know, and it's sunny tomorrow. You know what I mean? Yeah. Kind of look at the wind, you know, look at your chart, you know, when you're looking at a map and you've got it laid out, you know what I'm saying? You're looking at a river, you know, and you're like, all right, here's the boat land that I'm putting in at, whatever. And you're looking at the river and the river goes 90% northeast, you know, for a big chunk of it. And you're going to be all in that section right there. You know, already you're going to be in that section and the river's pointing northeast. And then you go, okay, well, it's, you know, let's say it's pointing northeast and it's an incoming tide. So let's say the south end of the river is where the tide comes in at. So the water would also be going northeast up this river. If you get out or you're pre-planning, you look at your weather and you're looking at the, you know, forecast for tomorrow, you're trying to plan ahead and they go, man, there's a 15 mile an hour northeast wind. All right. And you only have the morning to go. All right. And you already know it's going to be incoming tide. So tide's going northeast up your northeast facing river and the wind's coming out of the northeast, which is a direct headwind into where you're fishing at. Odds are, if you were to call me and say, Ronnie, that's the only place I know to go. I have no other options. I'm probably going to say, man, unless you're just looking to get out of the house, find something else to do. And the reason I'm going to say that is because of this. And let me explain. You're on a northeast facing river with a very strong northeast wind coming head in, and you have an incoming tide. A lot of the times that wind on that surface is going to succumb that water. So if you're in an area and the fish in that area are already expecting, you know, the bait to be coming a certain way and floating a certain way or coming at them from the left or whatever, but yet the wind's holding the water off, the water's not moving. You know what I mean? And yep. it might even kind of swirl around a little bit, but it almost makes it stagnant. So it almost goes to the same as a slack tide. And that's going to be where it's going to be very non-productive scenario, basically.
All right, that's so helpful, man. We've, you know, for years, we hardly even looked at the wind, you know, like it was more about, hey, what's the tide doing? And, it's crazy how important that is, regardless of where you fish. I mean, it helps us eliminate, like you're talking about, quickly, either times or places that you want to avoid. Because that's a big thing we always teach people is we call it the 90-10 rule. That, hey, I'll start just like a haystack, right? If I said, Ronnie, here's a big haystack, I want you to go find a needle, you're like, man, that's going to take me a week. But if I said, all right, I'm going to take 90% away of it and just give you the 10, it's somewhere in the 10. I'm not going to tell you, but it makes it a whole lot easier. So do the same thing with fishing, right? Like, hey, let's eliminate the places we know the redfish aren't going to be and just keep narrowing it down. And the wind is a big, big piece of that. So, all right. One thing I love to do to end is talk about, hey, if you could have like one spot, you know, one tide and one lure, what would it be? You've already answered the lure and really the tide. You said incoming tide and a spinner bait.
I like the top of the incoming.
Okay, top of the incoming and a spinner. Yep. What kind of structure, what type of spot? If you could only pick one and you knew you had to catch a ton of redfish and or trout.
Awesome, man. So I'm going to kind of make this down to a very easy to isolate spot. So being that I know I have the most hookup success at higher incoming water. You know, overall, it's going to be the most fish produced at higher incoming water for me and for what we do. I'm going to be looking for an area that what I call is a landlocked bank. That being said, I'm not going to be going to a grass flat or spot that's going to have, you know, like something a flood tide fisherman might be looking for. You know, you're not going to want that. You're not going to want an area that everything could kind of be spread out and pushed back. I'm going to be rolling along, and if I'm looking at a maps or something, this makes it real easy. So if you're looking at, you know, geo maps and you're kind of looking at layouts and you can see where the flats and stuff are out, look for areas where there might be like forest point or a rock point or something that comes to the edge of the bank or an island, you know, anything that's going to fix that land solid to where the edge of that water is at, to where the fish can't go back beyond right at the edge of the structure. So now that you know you're looking for a spot that's going to be a landlocked type spot where the water can't go beyond like the rock wall, you know, a rock wall with some grass on whatever, there's no way the fish can go past that because it's land, it's dry, you know what I mean? Yep. So that's going to lock them in. And once you find one of those areas that's going to be productive in holding fish, that's going to be where I'm going to be at that higher water, getting it done, especially for the redfish, 100% for the redfish. Absolutely.
Cool. That's awesome.
We do the best on the big ones at that high income as well.
That's awesome. So landlocked banks, spinnerbait, top of the incoming. It's deadly. I love it, dude. That was super helpful. I feel like we could definitely do a part two of this because I still had a bunch of questions, but I don't want to go too long. So tell everyone where they can find you to either book a charter, book one of these, kind of little on the boat seminars, if you will. What's the best way to reach you?
Man, you can look us up on Facebook, Instagram, or Google, allinonecharters.com, but allinonecharters on Facebook or Instagram. And I also have a personal little page on Facebook where I answer questions and help people out. And this is where my personal tutorials and stuff go up for the on boat. And that's going to be Captain Ronnie's Tips and Tricks for Charleston. And that's going to be on Facebook. You just Captain Ronnie's Tips and Tricks, and it'll pop right up for you. Should be no problem.
I'm writing that down. We'll put that in the show notes. And then allinonecharters.com is the site. And he's got a couple great videos too on YouTube that I saw. And I'll embed some of those from your YouTube channel in the blog post as well, where you can actually see kind of what he's talking about on the water, where he's making some of those precision cast. And, and dude, like every video I watched, you hooked up within like, I don't know, 7 seconds or less. I was like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, awesome. We've been getting a lot of pressure. We just started to do those, man, because so many people have been asking us to do it. So we're just getting into it, but we're trying to get a little breakaway time. We can start making some real legit, nice videos of stuff to help explain what's going on.
Yep, awesome. Super helpful, man. We need more captains like you that are just willing to share. And I know talking offline to you, because you've shared so much and you're just helping so many people, it's been really good for your business, and you're attracting a lot of people your way, and you deserve it, man. So everyone, go make sure to follow Captain Ronnie on all those social media platforms. Book them, especially if you're in there in South Carolina area. Even if you're not, I'm sure he'd love to have you on the boat, even if you don't live in South Carolina. So,
oh yeah,
brother, thank you again. This is super helpful. And you guys, if you have any questions for myself or Captain Ronnie, let me know. We'll post this at saltstrong.com/podcast. You'll see it right up at the top. So saltstrong.com/podcast. You can leave us a question and we will get back to you then. You guys rock. We are out of here. Thank you, brother.
Absolutely, man. 'Cause fishing, it's in my soul. It was pain.